the nation's capital. This is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, back at our microphones, Will Marling. He is the executive director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, www.trinova.org, www.trinova.org. We're going to be talking about a variety of topics in terms of victim assistance in America. Will, welcome back to DC Public Safety.
Len, thanks so much. You know, this is one of my favorite things to do. I just really enjoy our time.
Well, the remarks that I get from LinkedIn and the other social media sites, plus our own website, seems to indicate that you're very popular. Every time I bring you on, we get nice comments. So we want to start off with a constitutional amendment for victims. You know, one of the things that always boggles the minds of everybody is that the overwhelming majority of the criminal justice system is there to protect the rights of defendants, but very few rights are there to protect the rights of the victim. And we have a variety of states, somewhere about 30, that do have state constitutional rights to protect victim rights. But what we're talking about is a federal law to establish a strong victim's presence in the courtroom and in law enforcement and the rest of the criminal justice system, protecting victims' rights when a federal law is violated, correct?
That's right. I mean, we're talking about the highest law of the land, which is the United States Constitution, our founding document. And so this represents an amendment to that founding document to affirm rights for victims of crime specifically.
And how's that coming?
Well, it's moving. We're moving forward. You know, a lot of folks that listen to your program, things like this aren't clearly visible because there's a lot of activity. You know, there can be between 10 and 12,000 bills introduced into Congress during the course of a two-year session. And so, you know, there's a lot of noise, as I might say it, in the bills. But we are continually educating House representatives specifically. It's House Joint Resolution 40. And the main thing that we're doing, apart from just educating them, is asking for their co-sponsorship. They can literally put their name on an official support list and said, yes, I will co-sponsor House Joint Resolution 40. And so it's a continual effort to build momentum, to educate, and to move it forward.
How could you not support victims' rights? I mean, I would think that the entire Congress would get behind this.
Well, we agree. I mean, the reality is that when people are asked on the street, you know, should victims have rights, it's an overwhelming response in the affirmative.
Right.
And most people, even those who might resist this, would affirm victims' rights. I mean, there are some folks who are purists and say, well, we really shouldn't amend the Constitution. And, you know, I commonly say, well, I agree, maybe not very frequently, but the reason it's to be amended is because it needs to grow and change. There are some that are concerned that it would impact the rights of the accused or defendants. And we simply respond that that is not true either. We affirm that those rights need to be there. And the Bill of Rights, the amendments designed to protect those accused of a crime need to be vigorously upheld. We're only saying that victims of the crime of which that person is accused, they need to be able to have standing under the law to affirm dignity, affirm the right to information, the right to restitution if this follows through. And the right to be part of the process officially, that's really what this means.
Well, you have a lot of federal crimes that are in the news lately in terms of the military. And so what you have is a situation where a lot of women within the military are basically claiming that they were sexually assaulted. They are stated, and advocates have stated, that they have been ignored and their rights have been ignored. This would provide them with the rights that they seek, correct?
Yeah, it would, because an American under the Constitution can affirm rights that are inculcated in that Constitution. You know, we say inalienable rights, and what we mean by that is there are some things that we just know are true. The average person knows they're true, but we still have to state them in the Constitution. They have to become part of a written document so that somebody can say, hey, right here, we've said this. And in the military context, that's especially true. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, historically, there really are no rights as such for the victims of crime. Now, I will say that in the latest National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, coming out, there have been some very positive progress with the affirmation of protections for victims. But nonetheless, this is, you know, this, as I like to say, an amendment would cover a multitude of sins. It would address this issue of victims' rights, crime victims' rights, but also it would affirm at large, even those people who don't engage in the criminal justice process as victims, it would create a national discussion about what rights are, what rights should be, and hopefully raise the level of prominence, the needs that people have when they're harmed by others.
And about 30 states or so have these rights, and the process in those states that do have a constitutional right, a state constitutional right, guarding the rights of victims of crime, it's worked in those states. It's been a sea change. My experience has been that everybody is now very much attuned to the rights of victims because it's the law. And in some cases, you've got to spell it out. In some cases, you've got to make it crystal clear. That's what others have said to me. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Now, I will affirm that of the 33 states that we know have crime victims' rights in the state constitutions, the affirmations in those state constitutions vary from place to place. In other words, what they affirm as a right can be different in another state. But let me give you the example of Arizona that has had victims' rights for, you know, 20 years, and they've been able to demonstrate that the process can be safely adjudicated so that the rights of the accused are not impinged upon, and the rights of victims can be affirmed so that a process can pursue justice, you know, an equitable justice. We know that there are inequities, Len, in the system, at, you know, in many ways. And I recognize that even in my victim advocacy role, that the accused many times, you know, can be shortchanged from anything from, you know, the defense attorney that they've been assigned or whatever. But we want to and vigorously want to affirm the rights that everybody should have. And we also say that victims themselves, they want a good and healthy process for everybody. They don't want a process where the accused is shortchanged, because commonly that just means an appeal, another trial, more and more pain and suffering for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's really why a fair and balanced system can serve everyone.
But speaking of pain and speaking of a sense of injustice, the average person going through the criminal justice system before a state constitutional amendment would oftentimes say that it's the criminal justice system itself that acts as a inhibitor to the healing process. That if the state criminal justice system or the federal criminal justice system is going to be so difficult to deal with, and where rights are not respected. I mean, can you imagine a person going through a violent crime and a family member is a victim of a violent crime, and now they find it's just an impossible process in terms of getting the information they need, getting the information they seek, getting the respect that they deserved, and having their day in court. If that was not recognized, if that was not embraced, then that victim is almost re-victimized. And I've heard that from crime victims before the constitutional amendments over and over and over again, that the criminal justice system re-victimizes me by not respecting my rights.
You're exactly right. Of course, it's one of the many reasons I like you, because you're in tune with many different facets of the criminal justice system. What we hear as well is re-victimization, re-traumatization, common themes. Why? Because the system itself is a system. It's a machine. It's designed with sometimes harsh mechanisms that are without respect for humanity. That it's, you know, that's the system. But the people in the system are the ones that affirm the dignity and compassion that need to be affirmed for people who've suffered so egregious losses. And so that's all we're doing, is we're wanting to affirm those things. And we'd love for people just to do that automatically, that we would love for people in the system to affirm inalienable rights of crime victims that they actually, many people believe, are already there. They have no idea that they're not there. But we know that those need to be affirmed so that a victim can say, I have the right to this, and I want to assert that right, and I want that right protected.
If you're interested in additional information or if you would like to support the National Organization for Victim Assistance in terms of this endeavor, www.trinova.org, www.trinova.org. Well, we're going to move on to the next topic, distance learning with the Victim Assistance Academy. You guys are doing an awful lot of training. You were doing training for the Defense Department in terms of training the trainers, if I remember a previous conversation. All throughout the history of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, you all have been involved in training victims advocates throughout the country, throughout the world. Then the next big step a little while ago last year was your work with the Defense Department, and now you're talking about a distance learning Victim Assistance Academy. Talk to me about that, please.
Yeah, thanks. Just stepping back a little bit, just to quantify what we're doing, you're exactly right. We do a lot of training, and it's particular in this area of victim advocacy and our side of house with crisis response. A lot of these things revolve around the skills necessary to advocate for people, but also trauma mitigation, trauma education in working with those harmed by crime and crisis. With the Department of Defense, we are actually the secretariat for what's called DSACP, the Department of Defense Sexual Assault Advocate Certification Program. So we've actually collected subject matter experts, and they are part of a committee built upon the National Advocate Credentialing Program that certifies victim advocates specifically in the United States military, all branches. And that's been a wonderful experience for us, of course, and we've been grateful for the privilege of serving in that way, but also encouraged by, steps, small and large, that are being taken in dealing with sexual assault, specifically in the military. And out of that kind of context of seeing needs and the like, we hit on this issue of a distance learning victim assistance academy. Now, let me explain that one. And since, the mid-80s, when we actually had the vocation of victim advocate emerge, there are a number of states who have developed their own victim assistance academies. And it's kind of a standardized approach with a 40-hour basic training that touches various skill-based aspects of advocacy. And it's a very important training. In fact, it's foundational if you're going to be a national advocate, nationally advocated advocate credentialed person. You're going to have at least a 40-hour basic. And what we discovered in our work was that not only are there a number of states who don't have academies, but there are a number of people who are far-flung who don't have access to that kind of training very readily. And so we have recently launched NOVA's National Victim Assistance Academy, and it's a distance learning concept. In other words, it's real time with an instructor using technology so that there's a classroom and people are logging in their remote sectors, and they're seeing the instructor as well as seeing a presentation, and they can talk to the professor. We encourage that. We encourage live audio, Q&A, interaction. And the powerful thing about this is the distance learning dimension means the distance is removed. People are actually taking this training in all parts of the world, all across our country. They're in Asia, they're in Europe, and other parts. So we are not only pleased and honored by this, we find that people are extremely receptive to it. Plus, the instructors that we've lined up are heroes in this field, incredible subject matter experts, and many people just simply wouldn't get access to them otherwise. We just can't ship them around. So it's a great step for us, so hopefully the movement.
The bottom line is that anybody anywhere in the world can receive this training, and you have been on a previous program. We talked about the fact that you've been interacting with other countries throughout the world in terms of this whole concept of a constitutional amendment, this whole concept of advocating for victims. It's just not an issue within the United States. You've been interacting with people all throughout the world.
Indeed. Yeah. In fact, we're starting a consortium, nonprofit, international enterprise called Victims of Crime International. And I know that isn't especially creative, but what it does represent is this true focus of many people in other parts of the world understanding that victims of crime specifically need support, they need resources, and their voices need to be amplified to their national local and national leaders. And that's what this enterprise is about, specifically Victims of Crime International. And I think the training is going to contribute to that, hopefully, as we give people in for basically anybody that can get access online can, you know, be part of this.
We're halfway through the program. I want to reintroduce Will. Will Marling is the executive director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, www.trinova.org, www.trinova.org. Well, I do want to ask you, in terms of your interactions with people in other countries, I would imagine everybody has the same issue. I would imagine there's not a lot of difference between Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Kathmandu. I would imagine that when you're victimized, I would imagine the criminal justice system is oftentimes not the most receptive place they're not the most supportive place in terms of dealing with victims, dealing with their trauma, dealing with the emotional aspects of being victimized, dealing with their informational needs. I would imagine those problems exist wherever you are in the world.
I would agree. There can be varying reactions to, and you could understand that from the standpoint of even countries that maybe aren't strong on human rights. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're experiencing that. I thought it's kind of funny. You named two places, you know, that I actually have talked to people about this very issue, Kathmandu. And as well, you know, in New Mexico, of course, all across the country, they're incredibly gifted and committed people. And even in Kathmandu, it's fascinating. The young lawyer that I talked to there, who was really trying to propel the notion of victims' rights in the context of human rights, and he's just an amazing fellow. The challenge we do face in varying ways, and I say we because the human collective represents a commitment to justice anywhere and everywhere. And what we see is sometimes there's a difference in resourcing. That can be an issue. So, and that can be here. You can find remote locations in the country where there aren't as many resources to assist victims of crime, or you can find locations here where people aren't maybe well oriented as professionals to the needs that victims face. But certainly that is in other parts of the world. And that's why we're really trying to propel a global voice and a global eye concept for folks, so that if we can shout on behalf of other people in other places that their voice should be heard, we believe that can be beneficial for them as well as for victims here.
But it does get back once again to whether you call it a U.S. constitutional amendment or whether it's embodied within the law within different countries, that mm-hmm. if it's not embodied in code, if it's not part of law, if it's not part of the training of the judiciary, law enforcement, the individuals within the court system, individuals within corrections, if it's not embodied in law, it tends to be ignored or not taken as seriously as it should be taken.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, the European Union passed incredibly powerful legislation to affirm victims' rights and services. And this is it's called an EU directive in that context, because the European nations don't have a constitution as such. They're a union it's a confederation of states. So they have to have treaties between all of the member states. I believe there are 28. And yet their highest level at this point is an EU directive, and the most this victims' rights EU directive that's being implemented over the next year specifically. There has to be a plan put in place by every member state, but then, of course, promoting and implementing that goes well beyond. And so that's what we're seeing. You know, Europe is seeing the need for this.
The steam is picking up. The momentum continues to move forward just in the United States and throughout the world.
That's exactly right. The word momentum is a great word, Lynn, because it represents what we're trying to see happen and what we are seeing happen.
All right. We've talked about the philosophical underpinnings of victims' rights in the United States. Let's get down to something very practical and very real. Target credit cards. Now, the National Organization for Victim Assistance has been involved in cybercrime for the last 2 or 3 years. You told me on a previous program that you've got so many calls from so many people regarding cybercrime that the National Organization for Victim Assistance was willing to move beyond its traditional role in terms of what I refer to as garden variety street crimes and domestic violence and sexual assault and robberies and burglaries and those sorts of things into cybercrime because simply there was a demand for it, correct?
That's right. Yeah, what we were seeing was the cyber, of course, is an extremely popular type of crime. And naturally, the cyber permeates everything we do. We're all interconnected. And so we're getting victim assistance calls. We take thousands of victim assistance calls on our toll-free victim assistance line every year. And when we began to see this this uptick, definitely in requests for help and assistance, we said, okay, we need to pay attention to this. And it quite honestly, it just meant definitely, boning up on a lot of the dimensions that are impacted here. And so we began to train ourselves internally. We did a lot of training with staff. And so we do victim assistance that way. And the target breach represents, quite candidly, one of many different types. It was a high-profile event, and we had calls on behalf of folks who had experienced compromise there. You know, ironically, Target itself is considered, one of the stronger security-committed companies, and they have a lot of appropriate and meaningful policies in place. But when you're talking about a breach that, as I see it or understand it, occurred, you're talking about, mechanisms that were able to break into basically vaults of information. So it's very profound, and it's scared people.
The Washington Post the other day editorialized that it's time to embrace the European model. And from what I understand in terms of the European model is that it's a chip and code-based system. So if you don't have the chip and if you don't have the code, you don't have access to the information in the card. But the really interesting factor is that right now, if you're victimized through your credit card, you're not liable. You don't have to pay those credit card bills in the European model. Model, evidently, once they make the move over to the chip and the PIN system, then suddenly you're stuck with paying those bills if a bad guy gets a hold of your credit card information. Is that correct?
That's right. Well, the chip and PIN is a significant mechanism to protect information. In our country, of course, a credit card compromise like that is considered technically a crime against the bank. That's why it gets a little complicated because people's lives are impacted by it. When my credit card number was breached I didn't lose track of my card. They got the number from somewhere. The bank was the one that took on that liability. Now, under federal law, if you report your loss, you can be liable. It's 3 days. You can be liable for $50 up to 3 days. Between that and 60 days, your liability can be $500. I've never heard of any bank charging to that consumer. So they consider it, I think, a cost of doing business. But what the chip and PIN can do, and I used to live in Europe where that chip and PIN was important, that chip and that PIN have to be, that they have to work together, and that significantly limits the risk associated with breach. And it also means that for the bank's sake, it's an opportunity for them to detect when consumers are actually committing the fraud, because they have to say, well, I'm taking you or your word. I mean, I had to sign affidavits saying, I basically swear that that I didn't cause this. I'm not making a false claim, to affirm that I didn't make those charges that somebody else had. I actually think it could be helpful for everybody. But, in our society, it's an issue of convenience. And that's what we're trying to encourage people to think about. Okay, so it takes a little bit more time to make a transaction. That's okay. So it takes you another 15 seconds. Okay.
Give everybody and those of us in the criminal justice system the three quickest tips to keep ourselves safe from this sort of crime.
Well, yeah, we kind of work from a principle or try to use principles that kind of can be a little pithy maybe to help people remember. We tell people, you are your data. Think about it in that way. When you get a call and it's a voice, you don't actually know who that person is. You think you do because you want to believe what they're saying to you. But you have to think, they want your data, and they're going to try to get that out of you. Another principle is very simple. If it has a lock, use it. If your phone has a lock, use it. If anything electronic has a lock, your computer, use your lock. Why? Very few people, even if they would say they live in a safe neighborhood, they don't lock their car when they lock their car when they get out of it. They use a remote, lock it up. We also this is a really important one in my view. It's, you know, if somebody asks you for information, it's perfectly acceptable to say, okay, what for? You know, and then when they tell you what for, you can decide, I don't know if that's important enough.
So the bottom line is being unbelievably judicious in terms of providing that information to anybody. And if you have questions as to whether or not you're talking to the real deal, if you're interacting with the real deal in terms of an internet message, is to call the bank, call the store, not through the telephone number that they provide, but you look it up, you go on the internet, you look up the number, and you call them, and you call the billing department and said, okay, I've got this email message from supposedly you guys. Is this legit?
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, there are all kinds of scams. I'll just give you one that came to me yesterday. I got an email from allegedly from the Arizona Court of Appeals.
Really?
And so, yeah. And so the idea was, oh, that's terrifying. You know, what's going on? Well, I knew it was bogus, but you know, we're busy. You're not paying attention. And so you, even there, you say, when asked for, they were asking for me to click this link and follow up. Well, I'm saying to myself, well, what would they want that for? Why would they be emailing? Of course they wouldn't be. So once we even stop, most of the time, if we just stop and ask a couple of basic questions, wait a minute, then it all rings true, it all rings false, and we can just stop. But it's easy to get paranoid these days, especially if people are telling you stuff.
All of us in the criminal justice system, even those who are suspicious of everybody because we've been in the criminal justice system for so long, we still get fooled.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a common, primarily because we're busy people and there's a lot of data passing. And so, you know, if an email gets into your network and somebody doesn't reject it and they forward it on to you, that could be right there the linchpin pulled to access your network. Well, how does that happen? It's not hard. I mean, again, we're busy people. So it's diligence.
Just a couple minutes left. Well, you know, when I did auto theft campaigns years ago, we recognized that if the auto industry just implemented certain security procedures in cars, it would drive down auto theft considerably. And auto theft over the last 5-6 years has plummeted because of that. There are many people who are basically saying, look, they're out there stealing iPhones. They're out there stealing iPads. They're stealing my electronic devices. Why aren't the companies making these devices to the point where they can be completely worthless? The companies can shut them down. People are saying, why can't credit card companies make a credit card in such a way that it's useless if somebody steals it or steals the information? Do you guys get involved in those sort of endeavors, working with the automobile manufacturers, working with the credit card companies, working with Apple and other smartphone manufacturers to improve the security of devices?
Well, we sure would. I mean, we're willing and committed to speaking into these issues, not just from a victim standpoint, but a potential victim or consumer standpoint. But, you know, you find a lot of forces at work. We know right now that within any given cell phone, you could have basically a kill switch. And, you know, there are pros and cons at different levels on that. I mean, some people would be concerned that my phone could be killed if somebody decided to do that outside of me. But we know that technology is available. You know, one of the areas where we kind of stumbled into this is an area where cell phone contraband are making it into prisons. And that is making inmates accessible. It's giving them access to the outside world. We know that they have committed significant crimes. They've called contract hits on, you know, prospective witnesses. They've harassed, they've stalked, and this kind of thing. Well, you know, it actually is a big problem. In one sweep in a California prison, it was 6,000 phones that were found. So it's things like that that have ancillary effects as well, not just, you know, some of the things even you named with, I lose my phone and all my information's on there. Man, I'd love for that thing to be destroyed, you know, remotely, because I don't want to have access to it. And I don't want them to have access to your phone, Len, because you might have, you know, we might have been talking about sensitive things. You might have email for me, my contact information that's private. So it behooves us all to pay attention to that very thing.
Well, I'm going to let you have the final word on that topic. I really do wish the National Organization for Victim Assistance and everybody who supports victims' rights throughout the United States to be supportive of a United States constitutional amendment for victims of crime currently working its way through the House of Representatives. And also, we are all supportive, needless to say, of additional. Every state in the United States should have a constitutional amendment protecting victims' rights. And I think we would completely agree on that. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today has been Will Marling, the Executive Director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance. www.trinova.org. www.trinova.org. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very, very pleasant day.